I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude is what we do. This one is with the cardiologist Bernard Laune, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for doing a most unusual thing among professions and trade unions. He organized his colleagues, more than 100,000 of them in the end, for a cause that had nothing to do with their pay or privileges. What they formed was IPPNW, International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, with Soviet doctors at a peak of Cold War anxiety. And in large measure, they brought Ronald Reagan and the Soviets Brezhnev, then Gorbachev, around to a start of disarmament in the mid-late 1980s. What this heart doctor from Boston handed the White House and the Kremlin was, in the title of his memoir, A Prescription for Survival. Dr. Laune, you can't introduce the work of your life better, I think, than you did impromptu in that emergency in Oslo on the eve of accepting the Nobel Peace Prize in 1985, when at a news conference, a man in the crowd had a sudden heart attack, cardiac arrest, and you and your Russian pal, Evgeny Chazov, jumped onto the man and started resuscitating him. And in the aftermath, you gave a wonderful summary of the moment and of your movement that you and Chazov had built. Just remind us of that speech, out of the blue.
You have to understand that occasion. The occasion was charged with venom. We were attacked in the media, in the radio. The German government, Prime Minister Kohl, demanded that a Nobel committee rescind the Nobel Prize. We were sitting with about 200 journalists. The majority of them wouldn't give us the right time. And they especially attacked Chazov as being a villain. There sitting was this Russian correspondent to whom Chazov was a hero. In despair and anger, he rose up to ask a question and he fell over dead. And here there was tumult. The media wanted to get best television views. We were trying to resuscitate the patient. They were pushing us away because the image is more important than a human life. And finally, the rescue squad came, and here a deja vu. The defibrillator I invented, the cardioverter, the drugs, everything coming up in this bizarre scene, unimaginable. If Hollywood had concocted it, you'd say, this is stupid. This is a fairyland. Life doesn't work that way. And eventually, they shocked him, and they couldn't bring him back to life. And they rolled out the body, and I thought he was dead. And somehow, in my mind, the symbolism, this man must live as a symbol of our movement of peace, of a surviving planet, you know. That's what it was. And here he's dead. And in despair and almost in tears, I began to talk. And here's what I said. We have just witnessed what doctoring is about. When faced with a dire emergency of sudden cardiac arrest, doctors do not inquire whether the patient was a good person or a criminal. We do not delay treatment to learn the politics or character of the victim. We respond not as ideologues, nor as Russians, nor as Americans, but as doctors. The only thing that matters is saving a human life. We work with colleagues, whatever their political persuasion, whether capitalist or communist. This very culture permeates IPPNW. The world is threatened with sudden nuclear death. We work with doctors, whatever their political conviction, to save our endangered home. You've just witnessed IPPNW in action.
You hadn't scripted it.
How would I have scripted it? How could I have scripted it? Could I have imagined a cardiac arrest? Could I have imagined such a scenario? I then broke down, and because the emotion was so intense. Here I come to be praised, to be honored, our movement, what we're doing to save an endangered planet, and here we're treated like criminals. And that juxtaposition of what was happening, the intensity of being honored, at the same time being abused as the lowest of characters, I just broke down and was there sobbing and embarrassed as all heck and covered my eyes. Mm.
Bernard Lahn, this is a magnificent book, and I must say it kind of confirms you as the kind of poster child for a sort of humanitarian monomania, if I may say. I thank you, my children thank you, my grandchildren and their grandchildren thank you for putting this whole nuclear madness, and it's getting to be history, not quite yet, but putting it in perspective. Give us the short form of what got you there and got you through it.
Well, Chris, you're asking such a difficult and searching question, because you're asking, why am I? Why am I what I am? The point of it,
I'd love to know.
We are the composite of, we are partaken of everybody about us. We have inherited thousands of generations. We have been forged by the environment, by experience, and I by the Jewish tradition, a prophetic tradition, a tradition which honors the book, honors the word, honors the dedication to justice above all else, where in Jewish teaching it says to save a life is like saving the universe. Mm. Nothing can be more important than to save a life. Mm. Okay, within that tradition, I was a doctor, and I happened to be involved with the subject of sudden cardiac death, which was the leading cause of fatality in the United States. Every 90 seconds somebody dies. And what is sad is in 25% of victims, this is the first announcement of having had cardiac disease. Mm. And what I realized in my early research in the late 1950s is that this type of death was an electrical derangement of heart rhythm, easily reversible and even preventable. So these were hearts too good to die. Mm. This wasn't a death that was inexorable because of age, because of cancer, because of failure of heart muscle. This was an accident. Mm. And at that point in my life, you know, I'm at almost at the height of my medical career and I'm doing some exciting thing. I couldn't sleep at night out of excitement because time was never enough to do what was necessary. Great discoveries. And every day that I waited, 1,000 people died, or more. 2,000 people died every day, just in the United States. What about the rest of the world? So at that point, I encounter, quite coincidentally, a British speaker, Philip Noel Baker. He had just won the Nobel Peace Prize. He was lecturing in Boston. He was lecturing in a home in Cambridge. And I went to listen to him, and he talked of us as the doomed generation, that none of us will see the year 2000. Mm. The reason? The nuclear arms race. And suddenly my thinking took a 180-degree turn. The analysis, I couldn't shake the fact that the leading cause of death that was threatening people was nuclear death, not cardiac death. And Herein, by temperament, I cannot live with my anxiety. Hmm. So I act. Action is the best antidote to anxiety. So what can I do? I called together, right where we're sitting here, a young bunch of doctors, all younger than me. I was then 40 years old. Mm. They were all in their late 20s, early 30s. And I said, let's talk about nuclear war. They thought I was a little insane, but I was already distinguished. And they thought I wasn't a run-of-the-mill crazy. I was a responsible doctor. They liked to listen to my lectures, attend my rounds, respected my judgment. So they came, and we began a dialogue. And the moment they began to read about it, they were aware, as I was, that clearly the world is living on borrowed time. And what can we do about it?
This is when you did that study of the aftermath, in effect, of a nuclear attack on Greater Boston.
Exactly. Exactly. Boston hit by a nuclear bomb, a hydrogen bomb. Out of 3 million people, 1 million would be instantly dead. 1 million would be fatally injured and die soon, a horrific death. 500,000 would be injured and wouldn't die immediately. Out of Boston's then 6,000 doctors, only 1,000 would survive and still able to practice. But how do you practice medicine without electricity, without water, without sewage, without drugs, without instruments, without scalpels, without electricity, without travel? How do you practice medicine?
And this I got to remind us, it was early Kennedy administration. Kennedy, who himself said that shelters were useful and important.
Right.
I'm not sure that wasn't the end of the whole shelter mania.
We ended it. Mm. If nothing else we did at the time, this mania of shelters was destroying American society because people were building shelters and putting weaponry in them to keep neighbors out. Love thy neighbor as thyself suddenly disappeared as you put a submachine gun in your shelter and you loaded it with the Geiger counters and water and food. For the case of, and what our study found, what we did very good job, remarkable job of research. We went to Dresden, studying Hamburg, studying the firebombing of Tokyo and 150 other cities. And what we concluded is that the firestorms of regular bombs multiplied 100,000-fold by a nuclear bomb would create crematoria. Mm. And a shelter is a crematoria. Mm. And if you enter a shelter, there's no way you'll survive. You might survive if you don't enter a shelter, but never if you enter a shelter. Because the firestorms would suck out all the oxygen. In addition to the thousands of degree temperature, you'd be incinerated, suffocated instantly, incinerated, and then irradiated for good measure.
One of the things that fascinates me from a human standpoint, Dr. Lown, is that you acknowledge in the book you were not technical masters on radiation, much less nuclear weaponry, and yet you plunged. There's a big lesson there somehow about, for all of us, what?
This is what doctoring is all about. Doctoring is professionalism. A technician cannot act unless full instructions are given. 1 to 10, all these numerals are there. Hmm. A professional who acts as a doctor or any professional doesn't have the facts. He has some facts, he has some experience, but he has to couple it with judgment. And the moment he gets that all together, synthesizes it, he can then take action on an inadequate data. And we were acting as professional doctors with inadequate data, what is ailing humankind, and saying, here's what's likely to happen. Now, there's an interesting aftermath because you touched on a very sensitive nerve. Mm. The sensitive nerve is we were sitting here researching, studying, and you're a scientist studying psychological effect, you're a trauma, you're a burn, you're a radiation. We realized that much of the information was then secret, was classified. So when we were writing our articles, we thought we were going to be beheaded, ridiculed, made oaths by the Pentagon. Well, they say, well, these guys don't know what they're talking about. But it so happened that we got most of the research reprint requests from the Pentagon. 500 reprint requests from the military. As a matter of fact, the military sent somebody to Boston to negotiate with us. Would we become consultants because we knew more about the medical consequences of nuclear war than anybody alive then.
It's also such a
bizarre, absolutely bizarre, that here they're utilizing, building a weapon arsenal, and they don't know the consequences of it, the human consequences of it. What does it tell you?
It's fascinating that they came and asked you.
Well, it's. I think they came and asked us, and maybe that sounds mean-spirited, and I don't want to be, that they came to ask us to shut us up.
Sure.
Because they says, if you're going to sign up, we're going to give you a lot of money, you know, right, to do the research. You'll have an office, secretaries. You'll have all the putness of affluence. But it'll all be classified. So thereafter, nothing that we do will be go out in print to the public.
Of course, they would have co-opted you, and you. I take it you didn't. You didn't
we
move to the Pentagon.
No way. No way. We'll be without a secretary.
But there's also a fascinating parable of politics there, isn't there? About what we value. Is it experience? Is it judgment? Is it instinct? Is it what? In making these big stabs of your life work, there's never enough information going in, and there's never enough information about the people we're choosing for president either. I mean,
that is why it's so essential, where throughout the book I hint, I state, one has to have a moral compass, because instinct, judgment, experience, facts, all of them are inadequate to give you a sense of where you are standing and where your destination must be. And here, morality, which is probably one of the oldest things that human beings possess, like language, you know, Chomsky speaking about language being hardwired in our brain. I am persuaded that morality is hardwired in our brain, because otherwise you couldn't have had human beings on Earth. Because the human being is so weak, he hasn't got fangs, he hasn't got claws, he hasn't got, you know, sharp incisors. He has nothing. He has community. And community is strength. And that was Darwinian, adopted, accepted over thousands of years ago. So now a little child knows this is right, this is wrong. This wasn't handed down alone from Mount Sinai. It may have been. But it was something embedded deep in our genome, in our DNA, morality. And we are ashamed of it sometimes. We ignore it at the peril of our nation, at the peril of our society, at the peril of our community, at the peril of our family, and at the peril of our dignity.
Bernard, on the thread that fascinates me so in this book is the persistence of your radicalism, a radical mind with a very, very practical notion of applying it. And I really wonder, just as a human being, for myself, for anybody, how did you sustain this kind of uncompromising vision of a place that you and all of us had to go?
Well, radical is not an insulting word. Radical means going to the root of something, and I always wanted to know first cause. Not in the Thomas Aquinas way, the cause uncaused, but, you know, in a way to get to the bottom of things, to not to nibble around. Life is too short to nibble at a leaf when you should be going at a root. And that was my mentality, my character, I guess. And I also believed that there is great injustice in the world. And I also began to understand, and that was the most profound thing emerging from the book, if one reads it carefully, that the Cold War ultimately wasn't driven by ideology, communism versus capitalism, or capitalism versus communism, or America versus Russia. It was driven by a far deeper problem. And that problem is what I call the Christopher Columbus era. Now, what Christopher Columbus did is show Europeans in the 15th and 16th century that great wealth could be amassed without much labor. You can expropriate it. You may have to kill people, you may have to commit genocide, you may have to colonize, but you can acquire enormous wealth out there and call them uncivilized barbarians, or you're bringing Christianity to them. Use some ideologic term that will satisfy the goodness in people, this moral sense that I talked about. But you always have to satisfy it to act in a nation. You can't act without it. The Hitlerites couldn't act without it. The communists couldn't act without it. The United States can't act without it. We bring democracy to the Middle East. Well, it has nothing to do with democracy, but you have to do that because that's the Darwinian legacy that you have to respond to.
I want to ask a question that you don't really answer in the book. There you are, the ultimate freelance, often always out of step with your own government, sometimes fighting directly against its policy. Why didn't they destroy you? Why didn't they rub you out or drop you out of a plane or besmirch your character along the way?
That's an interesting question. They could have besmirched my character very easily because I had a terrible experience with the McCarthy period and I had kicked out of the military. So they could have readily destroyed the movement by attacking me. They could have done it. But they didn't, and frequently they were running interference for me. And I began to understand it after 1982, when the Catholic Archdiocese of Boston, which I deemed as very anti-communist, very conservative, rarely involved in peace issues, unlike Cardinal Bernardine in Chicago or the Detroit Archdiocese or even the Los Angeles Archdiocese, who I knew the heads of the church there, and they were good people, very good people. So why did they develop this award for me? And I wondered how Cardinal Medeiros could honor the head of a movement that was collaborating with the devil incarnate, with the atheistic communists.
So they were protecting you in some sense, but why?
In effect, at that moment, I realized that I'm safe because I was an asset. Because one of the big problems in the Cold War for us, in a very mysterious Byzantine Kremlin, is, are they going to strike at us? If so, when? Are they healthy of mind and body? What's going on with them? And we developed a whole bureau, as I relate in the book, in the CIA, who studies leaders of the world and their governments. They study everything. They look at videos. They look at movies. They record speeches. They like to get to the doctor and kibitz with him of the leader. They try even to collect urine samples and feces samples of him, because you can do enormous judgment from that about what's going on with somebody. If somebody talks and if a mouth is twisted a little bit, he had a stroke, or if he does that, he stutters or whatnot. So the CIA, according to the Wall Street Journal, was spending $2 billion a year on that to get to know what's going on within the Kremlin. So here imagine they have an American doctor whose closest friend in Moscow is the doctor of the Politburo, of Brezhnev and all this gang. You have entry to the Holy of Holies. Is that person valuable? That person is worth more than crown jewels. So I felt protected. The moment I reasoned it out this way, this would have been 1983. Until 83, I wouldn't have survived. I was a nervous wreck. Every day I'd wake up and I'd expect a headline. FBI discloses long leading communists working for the Moscow's being supported by that. There's some stupidities like that. And I was worried. But the moment I reasoned it out, I say, I'm safe. I'm totally safe. I'm protected by the U.S. government.
So you can put the CIA on your resumes.
Yeah, the CIA should go on my resume. I don't think I take pride in doing so, but I could.
Did you
After
ever take
all, the CIA? Why would I put on my resume? They are the ones who launched the Taliban. So why would I want that on my resume?
Did you ever take Brezhnev's pulse or Andropov's or anybody else's?
No, well, this is a medical question, sir. You know, a journalist invariably comes through with a low cut asking a medical question. I had Dushko Doda from the Washington Post that drove me crazy in Moscow. He said, I know you came here to see Andropov, and you got to tell me something about him. I never did. We remained friends.
I read this book, Bernard Lown, and I'm so in awe of your sustained, single, radical focus on one issue against huge risks and discouragement and professional and media uninterest and all that sort of thing. What sustains that prophetic search, that prophetic voice? I'm also wondering, where will we find the next one?
See, I don't like that question.
Go for it.
I don't like that question for several reasons, because in America, time and time ago, we go for the personality, the celebrity, the unique individual who can take us out of the desert, you know, the Moses, the Martin Luther King, the Gandhi. No, no, no. My view is different. My view, Chris, is you are important. Every human being is important. If we can mobilize people, my patients, if you can do that, you win. Because the political process ultimately is shaped by the wills, by the so-called Brownian movement. Now, what is a Brownian movement? Atoms, little tiny irrelevant atoms, are forging, chaotically back and forth. But that movement is what builds history, creates possibility. Let me give you one example. In the 1980s, we were held at hand length from the White House. We were regarded as, if not traitors, dupes. KGB dupes, Russian commie dupes who didn't understand it, who were undermining democratic institutions by talking to the Russians, our arch enemy. In 1983, at the Third World Congress, we had an annual, IPPNW had an annual World Congress every year, huge. Cultural, social, fun, but also the issues. Greetings from the Pope every year. Every year we get greetings from the Pope. Greetings from world leaders who came to talk to us. And I'm chairing the first plenary session. I'm called out by the U.S. ambassador to Holland. He says, Dr. Lown, would you read this statement? That statement was from President Reagan. Hmm. We had a journalist whom we asked to come and report for us, and we will pay his hotel and his travel. It's Robert Scheer, famous journalist from the Los Angeles Times at the time. When he saw Reagan's message, he gave us back the fees and the hotel. He says, this is too hot a story. I can't take any of your money, you know? And what did Reagan say? He says, nuclear war cannot be won or must never be fought. And then he went on wishing us well because we were doing what he totally supported. So you ask yourself, what happened? Here's the architect of the greatest speed-up, of the Cold War, sends us a message of love. What happened? A year before, 1 million Americans marched in New York, demonstrate against the Cold War, for the freeze. There were 5,700 different peace movements in America. The freeze movement was gaining. Congress voted a resolution in support. It was being passed in states where it was brought up on the ballot. And Reagan, or his group, or whatever, consummate politicians, they are, you can't be totally out of step with American people, period. So they asked, what's going on? Oh, there's a very reputable organization now, the Doctors Movement. You know, they're popular all over the world. They're having a Congress announcement, so let's send them a message. That became his mantra in the 1984 election, where people were worried that he was going to bring us into war. His motto was, Nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought. You heard it over and over and over again. That stands for Reagan. Mm. Here's the power of people. So to answer your question about, you know, where are we going to find another Laon? I say, don't look for another Laon. Mobilize, organize, get to know the community, begin to struggle at a community-based level and begin to put pressure on the establishment at the local level, regional level, and government level, and then you'll have a new society. And you have to make changes in America because America is becoming unlivable with itself. The disparity in wealth, the fact that we have no healthcare system, that we have right now 47 million uninsured, that we have 2 million people in jails. You know, Marion Wright Edelman was on radio just a few days ago, and she pointed out that a 7-year-old black child has 1 in 3 chances of being in jail in their lifetime. 1 in 3 of little black children age 7. 1 in 7 Hispanic children. 1 in 17 white children. We spend more, 2 or 3 times more on jails than we spend on college education of our youth. A society like that is doomed. And the crisis in Wall Street reflects what is going on in society. The moment you create great disparity of wealth, you create a dysfunctional society financially. And the moment you focus on the financial sector, you produce nothing. You're in a casino. What does Las Vegas produce? The industry and genius and creativity of the American people is leashed. It cannot express itself. It could express itself if we start building our intellectual resources, our industrial, our infrastructure that we have neglected for 50 years. And we are investing it in the military. It's the most corrupt thing to do. So it's time we stopped, and it's time we didn't look for Bernie Lowndes, and it's time we each did our share.
Bernie Lowndes, it's such a pleasure. Prescription for Survival is a hair-raising, enormously encouraging tale. I want to thank you for the book and thank you for this conversation.
It's always, Chris, a joy to sit with somebody probing, intelligent, and demanding serious answers.
Thank you, Bernie. Paul McCarthy and Sarah Archambault produced and edited this conversation with Bernard Lowndes. His book on the doctor's campaign against nuclear weaponry is called Prescription for Survival. Finish the conversation with your own 2 bits on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thanks for joining us.